From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how working families are doing in the current economy. We talk with Jared Bernstein, co-author of the new report, The State of Working America. Jared is a senior economist with the think tank, the Economic Policy Institute. Also, how Hollywood makes and markets blockbusters, and how that's changed the movies we see and the theaters we watch them in. We talk with Date Hayes and Jonathan Bing about their new book, Open Wide. They're both editors at Variety. And critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new 3-DVD set of American films made between 1894 and 1931. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How are working families doing in the current economy? That's the subject of the new edition of the biannual report, The State of Working America, a project of the think tank, the Economic Policy Institute. Later this month, Cornell University Press will publish the report in book form. My guest, Jared Bernstein, is a co-author of the report. He's a labor economist who joined the Economic Policy Institute in 1992 and took a leave to serve as deputy chief economist at the Labor Department in 1995 and 96 under President Clinton. The Economic Policy Institute, which was established in 1986, describes its goal as broadening the discussion about economic policy to include the interests of low- and middle-income workers. Bernstein says that the U.S. economy is in recovery, but the benefits are not reaching workers and families. This has been referred to as a jobless recovery. Would you still describe it that way?
Not at all, in fact. I think one of the more positive aspects of the recent recovery is that starting last fall, we began adding employment month by month. I don't think we've had a negative month for over a year. The problem is that the job growth has been a bit too tepid. Too often when we look at this question of whether jobs are growing or not, we're simply asking, are we adding jobs or losing jobs? That's too weak a criterion to evaluate the strength of the labor market. We need to not only add jobs, we need to add at least 150 to 200,000 per month. And unfortunately, months like that have been the exception to the rule.
Why do we need to add 150,000 to 200,000 jobs a month?
We need to add that many jobs per month in order to absorb all those people coming into the job market looking for work, as well as rehiring the millions who were laid off over the course of the recession and the jobless recovery. If we don't add that many jobs, the unemployment rate won't fall very much. And in fact, it's, I think, telling that the unemployment rate was 5.6% when this recovery began in November of 2001. And most recently, it's been around 5.4%, 5.5%. So we've actually made very little progress in terms of lowering unemployment, even while we're adding jobs.
So you're saying that we're really no longer in a jobless recovery. Jobs are being created. Is there any pattern you see in the types of jobs that are being created?
In fact, I'd say the patterns are evolving. When the jobless recovery ended in the fall of 2003, we started adding employment. We had a job quality problem. And in fact, you think back to the election, you heard candidate Kerry talking about how the new jobs paid so much less than the old ones. And he was talking about a problem in the quality of the jobs that we were creating. And in fact, on average, industries that were adding jobs paid considerably less than industries that were shedding jobs or growing more slowly. Things have improved a bit, and so I think that the quality of jobs we're adding now, by many dimensions, are okay. But one area where we still have a problem has to do with health care and pensions. Jobs that are being created now are far less likely to come with a more broad compensation package, including a decent health care program or a pension program. And in that sense, those jobs are of poorer quality.
Now, is this happening across the board, or is it only specific types of jobs?
You know, it's not happening across the board in the following sense. Those at the very top of the income scale have been doing far better than the rest. If you look at the trends in profits and compensation, you will see a very unique and unbalanced characteristic of the current economy. The rates of profit have really soared while compensation has been pretty flat. So while the economy's been growing, going back to our earlier discussion, there is an ongoing recovery underway. While the economy's been growing, most of the benefits have been flowing upward. So how you've done really is largely a function of where you are in that income or wealth scale.
What do you mean the benefits have been flowing upward? Can you give us an example of what you mean?
Sure. Historically, at this stage in a recovery, most of the growth of the economy is flowing into compensation. Say about 70% of the growth goes to wages and compensation, and about 30% goes into profits. Well, this time it's topsy-turvy. About 70% of the growth has gone to profits and only about 30% into compensation.
Is there any explanation for the trend that you've just described where more money proportionately is getting put into profits than into wages?
I think the explanation really lies with the job market. Really at the heart of this analysis is the notion that our labor market serves as a mechanism to distribute the economy's growth. The economy has been growing quarter after quarter, year after year, but unless the unemployment rate is far lower than it is today, unless we're creating many more jobs than we've been creating, unless we're really hammering away at that jobs deficit, we can't expect the benefits of growth to be broadly shared. They tend to flow upward. It really is almost as simple as an employer who's facing a very tight labor market has to raise wages and compensation to get and keep the workers that they need. On the other hand, when the line of labor supply is forming outside the shop or the factory, and there's lots of people seeking work, that is, there are more job seekers than there are job slots, that tends to put downward pressure on wage growth for many workers, and it leads to higher levels of inequality. This is, I think, the result that we're seeing really played out in today's economy.
Outsourcing is a word that Americans are becoming increasingly familiar with, and a lot of jobs that used to be done by workers here are now being done by workers in Bangalore, India, or other parts of the world. Have you crunched the numbers for outsourcing? And if so, what do they have to tell us?
Well, I've certainly reviewed all those numbers, and interestingly, they don't have a whole lot to tell us because it's very hard to know how many jobs have been outsourced or offshored. But let me say what I think we do know about it. First of all, for decades, we've been outsourcing employment in our manufacturing sector, and that's really led to the loss of millions of manufacturing jobs in this country. I think what's caught people's attention in recent years is that that phenomenon has crept up the scale, as it were. It's no longer affecting solely blue-collar workers. It's now affecting white-collar workers as well. And that's certainly a different trend and one that I think many have found alarming.
You know, a question you've raised is this, you know, a lot of people say, well, what workers really need now is better education and job retraining so that workers who have lost jobs can find new jobs and be trained appropriately for those new jobs. And you question whether that's really the issue right now.
I do and I don't. I mean, I certainly the idea of any individual seeking a higher level of skill or retraining makes sense for that person. However, there's a way in which this conversation, I think, gets very skewed, especially in the context of offshoring. You hear many economists talk about we simply need to reskill in order to be more competitive. But the people that they're talking about are some of the most skilled in the world. So, for example, if you talk about radiology, the idea that because we can now offshore these digital photos, x-rays and the like, hospitals can use radiologists in India and China, whereas before they didn't have that option. And that, of course, dampens the employment opportunities, the compensation of radiologists here. So, you know, the typical economist might say, well, that radiologist needs to become a pediatrician. That's a job that obviously can't be offshored so quickly. But the idea of retraining a radiologist to become a different type of a doctor raises this notion of training, raises the bar to a level we've never contemplated in our country. I mean, the training that we've done has always been on the low end, trying to provide the skills that, say, you know, high school dropouts need to make their way into the job market. So there's a kind of hand-waving that goes on, I think, when we talk about skill training that doesn't really deal with the realities of the offshoring challenge.
You know, because so much manufacturing and so many services have been outsourced to other countries where labor is cheaper, it means that some of the things we buy and some of the services we use are cheaper here. So does the average worker lose or gain in the long run, do you think? You know, on the one hand, you stand to lose your job. On the other mm-hmm. hand, the stuff you're buying is cheaper. It's like, can you figure out how that balances out?
Well, you're absolutely right to raise the plus side of the ledger, which is that thanks to all this globalization, prices certainly are rising less quickly than they have historically. And probably the best way to measure out the costs and benefits of that is to actually look at inflation-adjusted growth of income and wages, because that takes into account these price changes. And if you look since, say, the year 2000, you'll see that the typical family is actually about $1,500 worse off in real terms. That's about a 3% decline in their income. If you look at the low-income family, they're 6% worse off. So their losses have been twice as great. So even taking into account slower price growth, incomes for many of these families has grown more slowly. Now, part of that is because we've been through a recession, jobless recovery, but here we are 3 years into an economic recovery that, according to many commentators, has been pretty robust, yet many families are behind where they were just a few years ago. The reason why incomes have grown much less quickly at the bottom has to do with this notion of inequality, the idea that the growth in the economy has been funneled much more to those at the top than those at the bottom. There are a set of factors that have determined that result. We talked about the weak job market as one of them, but other factors include a decline in the minimum wage, less union power, more globalization. All of those factors have led to that outcome.
Now, you mentioned the decline in the power of unions as being one of the reasons why a lot of workers haven't kept up with the cost of living. Is there a way of measuring how much the power of unions has declined and what the percentages of workers who were unionized compared to 10, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, right now, about 9% of the private sector workforce is unionized. It's closer to 14 or 15 in the total workforce because the public sector has about a third unionization rate. But if you look at the private sector job market, it's about 8 or 9%. And if you go back to the heyday of unions, it was probably closer to 30 or 40%, something in that range. Now, part of that has to do with the loss of manufacturing jobs. I mean, manufacturing is a sector that's historically been highly unionized, and we've lost millions of manufacturing jobs over the past few decades. So that by itself has diminished union power. Now, unions have tried to make inroads into the services and have actually done pretty well. The service employee unions, I believe, is one of the fastest growing unions. But certainly, union power has diminished over the past few decades, and that's helped lead to these increased inequality results that I've been describing. I would say one of the main factors that determines the distribution of the economy's growth and thereby explaining why that distribution has been so unequal in the past few years has to do with the bargaining power of the workforce. Economists are typically taught that each worker is paid commensurate to their skills and to their productivity. So if you're creating a certain amount of wealth or value, that's what you're going to get in your wage. But in the real world, I would say an equally important determinant of how much you end up getting paid is the kind of bargaining power you might have. That may have to do with whether you're male or female, whether you're a minority or a white worker, whether you're at the top end of the management scale or at the bottom. It has to do with factors whether you're in a union, whether you're in a state with a higher minimum wage, et cetera. All of these bargaining power factors play a role, and they've been diminished for many in this workforce really over the past few decades. And that's one of the reasons why we've seen inequality on the rise.
My guest is Jared Bernstein. He's a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. He co-authored the Institute's new report, The State of Working America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Jared Bernstein. He's a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute, and he's co-author of their annual report, The State of Working America. And the newest version of that, 2004 to 2005, is about to be published in book form. Let's take a look at Social Security. The Bush administration says that we have a $10 trillion shortfall in Social Security and that this is threatening the entire system and causing a crisis, and that the cost of doing nothing to reform the system would be greater than the cost of acting now to change it. The way you crunch the numbers, does that conclusion fit with your analysis?
Well, not only does it not fit with my analysis, it doesn't fit with the analysis of the Social Security actuaries themselves, which may not be the most exciting group of people to raise on a radio show, but these actuaries have said that that kind of an estimate, that $10 trillion, I think they use the word, and I quote, misleading, because that $10 trillion deficit is the deficit in Social Security over an infinite horizon. If you took any branch of government, any program, if you looked at the military, if you looked at social spending, you'd find deficits that were equally large, if not larger. So it's really a meaningless number. Social Security is not in crisis. There is a problem with funding the program, and historically such problems have evolved in the past, and we fixed them with fairly minor tweaks. This one could be fixed similarly.
What effect on different income brackets do you think privatizing Social Security would have?
Well, that's an important question because so much of our conversation has focused on this notion of economic inequality. One of the things that many of us like best about Social Security, and I guess you could say many of the privatizers like least, is the fact that it's actually a pretty progressive program. Those at the lower end of the income scale do better with Social Security than those at the higher end. If you privatize the system, almost assuredly, you would really kill that progressive component and end up with a program that would reinforce inequalities. I mean, think for a second, who would do better in a program where you manage your own stock portfolio? Those at the top of the income scale who have the time and the knowledge, or at least can hire the people with the time and the knowledge to do that, or those at the bottom who typically don't have the experience, know-how to necessarily manage stock portfolios, or B, have the savings that they can really put into it, even with this diverting their payroll taxes into private accounts.
President Bush has already cut trillions of dollars worth of taxes and proposes to cut a few trillion more. And he says the cuts are helping the economy. How do you measure if the tax cuts are helping workers?
One of the best ways to measure whether the tax cuts are helping workers is to actually hold the Bush administration accountable for their claims regarding these tax cuts in terms of job growth. When the administration introduced their tax cuts, they argued that these tax cuts would create something like 300,000 jobs per month from the middle of 2003 through the end of 2004. Well, in fact, they've had 1 or 2 months with job growth of that magnitude. So in terms of job growth, the tax cuts have clearly been a failure. In terms of economic growth, I think they have helped boost the rate of growth in the economy. GDP would have grown more slowly in the absence of these tax cuts. But while these tax cuts have helped generate faster economic growth, the fact that they've never achieved the job or wage or income growth that they were advertised has meant that they really haven't delivered the goods to working families. Furthermore, if you look at who did benefit from the tax cuts, of course, it's been widely documented that the benefits flowed to, once again, to those at the top of the scale. The top 1% ended up with something in the $80,000 range in terms of their lowered tax liabilities from these cuts. Those in the middle maybe got about $1,000. Those at the low end got about $100.
When you're thinking about the long-term impact of the tax cuts, do you take into account the possibility that perhaps we haven't given enough time to see what the long-term beneficial effects of the tax cuts will be, that it's maybe just too soon to tell, and that more benefits will appear in the future?
Well, possibly, but I don't think so. I mean, the tax cuts actually did help the economy grow more quickly, and that's you could see that already in some of the numbers from the period when they were implemented. The long-term effect from the tax cuts was advertised to be greater investment. This is supply-side economics. If you cut the taxes of those at the top of the income scale, they will invest more, and this will lead ultimately to faster productivity growth. Well, the investment results certainly don't show that to be the case, and there's no reason why that shouldn't show up in the short term. And in fact, interestingly, productivity growth was growing quicker before the tax cuts than it has been since. So really, I think the long-term effect of these tax cuts will simply be a more unequal post-tax income distribution. That's an effect that I think we will see in the long term. I don't think anyone could seriously argue that there'll be growth enhancing in the long term. And by the way, the Congressional Budget Office has analyzed just that and came to the same conclusion.
There's always been differences in how economists analyze and interpret the economy. But I'm wondering if you think those differences have widened as America seems to have become more divided politically.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think they have widened. I think if you look back at the last, 4 years of the Bush administration, but you could even find this in 8 years of Clintonomics, there's been a prevailing view that free markets always yield the best result. I would say, the difference between, Clintonomics and Bushonomics is not so much the support for free market economy, which is really very robust in both cases, but in the Clinton case, it says, let the economy do its thing, and we'll redistribute a bit to help the losers. And in the Bush case, it's let the economy do its thing, and whatever happens, so be it. Really, if you go back to another era of economic thinking, that much more associated with older democratic politics or Roosevelt economics, this was a view that said market outcomes are not always the best outcomes, and that there are ways to intervene in market outcomes to ensure that we have the economy that we want and the distribution of income that is fair and equitable. And so it doesn't necessarily accept the notion that the free market left alone is always the best way to run things. I think that has been too widely accepted over the past few decades.
Well, Jared Bernstein, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jared Bernstein is senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. He co-authored the Institute's new report, The State of Working America, 2004 to 2005. It's about to be published in book form by Cornell University Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of astrologer Susan Miller's The Year Ahead 2005, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Open in as many theaters as possible and make a lot of money quick before the film bombs. Coming up, we discuss how blockbusters are marketed with Dade Hayes and Jonathan Bing, authors of Open Wide. And critic Lloyd Schwartz considers the music in the new DVD collection More Treasures from American Film Archives. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A blockbuster movie requires blockbuster marketing, and marketing strategies are now affecting what movies get made, how they're made, and where they're shown. My guests, Dade Hayes and Jonathan Bing, spent several years chronicling the film business for Variety, where they're now editors. Hayes and Bing have written a new book called Open Wide: How Hollywood Box Office Became a National Obsession. The book examines how big-budget movies are marketed by focusing on three that opened last year on July 4th weekend, Terminator 3, Legally Blonde 2, and the animated film Sinbad. A lot of your book is about the pursuit of getting a big opening weekend box office. And of course, on July 4th, since it's summer vacation and a holiday, a lot of people are available to go to the movies, so you could get a particularly big opening weekend if you're lucky. Why is there such a big emphasis in Hollywood on having a big opening weekend? What does it matter?
Well, one of the most important reasons for this fetish for opening weekend, is that films have such short shelf lives, especially the big blockbusters that are the subject of the book. I read in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago that Oliver Stone said that he'd worked for 3 years on the movie Alexander, and it was over in 3 weeks. These films come along and they have a wide opening. They open in thousands of theaters around the country. And within a few weeks, the world's forgotten about them. And they're onto the DVD.
And the number becomes a sales tool. You know, the number becomes a commodity that you can actually promote. That's what's happened in the last 20, 25 years, is that Spider-Man does $114 million in its first 3 days, the original film. And that becomes the event. That becomes the thing that people want to participate in. And it plugs right into this fascination with batting averages and stock quotes and, all these kind of bits of essentially trivia. But it kind of commodifies the movie-going experience in a way that people can understand and that the marketers can, try to deliver on that level.
If you want to get a big gross on the opening weekend, you have to open in as many theaters as possible, or open wide, as the expression is and as the title of your book goes. And opening wide has a new meaning now that there's megaplexes that have, 15 or 30 theaters in one complex. So how has the existence of megaplexes changed how films open and what the meaning of opening wide is?
Well, we chronicle in the book this phenomenon that came to be called the rescreening of America, in which giant megaplexes, and a megaplex is defined technically in the trade as a theater with more than 16 screens, were built across the American suburbs. And we focus on one suburb in particular, Ontario, California, which is about a half an hour's drive outside of LA, where there are two megaplexes next to each other, one with 30 screens, one with 22 screens. And at the height of the summer, blockbuster season, there's really nothing but blockbusters playing on these 52 screens. You won't find a single independent or quote-unquote art house film playing in this theater, and in either of those theaters. And so in a very direct way, it's limited the choices of American moviegoers.
That's so counterintuitive. You'd think 52 theaters in one little area, well, we'd be able to see everything in those theaters. So how come it has the reverse effect?
Well, it's kind of down to media consolidation. It's the same battle that's happening on cable television, where, it's the old line about, 100 channels and nothing's on, because all the same conglomerates are controlling those vertical revenue streams. And so, you have this cluster of theater companies that dominate the landscape. About five circuits own 85% of all movie screens in America. And it's about convenience, which is an interesting aspect to this. It's part of, just plugging this whole theater thing into the retail infrastructure and being able to offer showtimes every 10, 15 minutes so that, once you're kind of in that cocoon of shopping and eating and consuming, you then are be able, you'll be able to just sidle up to the line and buy a ticket anytime you want to see a movie.
And Terry, I thought it was important to add that it's really, opening wide is really the name of the game. And this year, films were opening wider and wider. In our book, we chronicle the global release of the third Matrix film, which was released in something like 18,000 prints around the world. And in a kind of curious publicity stunt, they released it at exactly the same fixed moment in time in every territory around the globe. This past summer, there were films like Shrek 2, which opened in 4,000 movie theaters, an unprecedented sort of level of saturation for Hollywood.
This campaign for Matrix Revolutions of opening simultaneously at the exact same second in movie theaters around the globe was actually very effective. What was the thinking behind it?
Well, it was trying to create a publicity gambit, a gimmick, and that goes back to the very origins, of these showmen producers, guys like Joseph E. Levine that we talk about In the book, he was the impresario and the marketing genius, really, behind movies like Hercules and Godzilla, where you kind of create this spectacle. And who cares, you know, how decent the movie really is, as long as you just pack the theaters in those very opening show times. And that was really all it was. They kind of knew what they had on their hands. They decided to stage this, you know, incredible spectacle. And the global marketplace, which is something we only gesture to because there's just not room for it, but it really has matured pretty dramatically. I mean, territories like Russia, Indonesia, places that you would never even think have 20-screen movie theaters, just like we do here in the suburbs in America. So that's another growth area that also played into the Matrix opening.
And I'll just add that it's a dirty little secret of the movie business that if you open a film in thousands of theaters simultaneously, chances are that you can generate a lot of money quickly before word gets out just how bad the film is. And with that third Matrix film, the reviews were just awful. But within the first 3 days, the film had generated practically $200 million around the world. So, you know, the smell can't really get out quickly enough when the film is opening everywhere simultaneously and there's just a mad rush to see it on opening night.
My guests are Dade Hayes and Jonathan Bing. They're editors at Variety and authors of the new book Open Wide about how blockbuster movies are marketed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Dade Hayes and Jonathan Bing. They're the authors of the book Open Wide, How Hollywood Box Office Became a National Obsession. And Dade Hayes is managing editor of special reports at Variety. Jonathan Bing is deputy managing editor at Variety. In your new book, you follow three films, Terminator 3, Legally Blonde 2, and the animated film Sinbad. So two of those films are sequels, Terminator 3 and Legally Blonde 2. Why are sequels so potentially lucrative?
They can be repeated again and again and again over various platforms, video games, toys, DVDs. They're doing direct-to-video DVD sales that would just blow your mind in animation. Some suggested that Sinbad should have gone direct-to-video. It would have made a lot more money. It's just an amazingly kind of systematized, industrialized process that fits perfectly into the MBA kind of models of the conglomerates running the studios. They want widgets. They want, you know, parts that they can stamp out again and again and again. And sure, they understand that the movie business isn't for the faint of heart, but they also want to inject some predictability and some kind of familiarity into the process. And they've also kind of helped cultivate this culture, if you think about the movies that have worked recently, comic book movies and, you know, fantasy epics and so forth, where there is a kind of serial appetite, and you could argue whether that's sort of, you know, nature or nurture, but I think many moviegoers have come to expect other installments and future installments. Certainly, we all regret some of the sequels that have been made, but there's now a real drive, a real business incentive behind sequels.
Well, let's look at Legally Blonde 2 for a second. This is one of the films that was focus grouped. It was screened for people who then rated the movie and said what they did and didn't like about it. What are some of the most important things that came out of listening to the focus group?
Well, one was this inherent problem with Elle Woods, who's the character played by Reese Witherspoon. You know, she was the perky sorority girl from the original film. Now she's going to Washington. And how do you invite people in to the world of Washington without completely, you know, flying over their heads or just dumbing it all down? And basically what they decided to do was excise politics entirely from a film that was set in Washington, D.C., in which the lead character, you know, works for a congresswoman. It was just a remarkable stripping away of every term, every scene, every you know, indication of something that reeked of social studies. That was what the audiences were saying, you know, don't give me that stuff. I want to see her, you know, having a manicure. I want to see, you know, the kind of the pleasure trip that the first movie was.
Sure, the teenage girls in the focus groups for Legally Blonde 2 wanted to see Elle Woods shopping. They wanted to see her chihuahua. They wanted to see her doing her sorority dances. They didn't want to hear about filibusters and political action committees.
I'm going to ask you to choose one of the three films that you write about in your new book, Open Wide, and tell us about what the trailer was and how it was, how the trailer itself was promoted and whether it was effective.
Sure. Let's talk about Sinbad. Sinbad was the animated film from DreamWorks that was a big disaster. It just, no one really knew what Sinbad was. It the advertising campaign didn't manage to really strike a chord with the wide audience. And the last, but there's extensive market research done in the preparation of the marketing campaign and in the last few months of post-production on the film. And one bit of intelligence that was coming back from test screenings was that the audience liked this character of Sinbad's dog. Sinbad, of course, is a character from The Arabian Nights, that ironically was, you know, this the film came out shortly after the invasion of Iraq, and in The Arabian Nights, Sinbad is actually a sailor from Baghdad who sets out from the port of Basra. None of that was very good marketing material for the film, and really that wasn't, the film itself was sort of cobbled together from a lot of myths, including the myth of Sinbad, but there was this character of Sinbad's dog, Spike, which was invented wholesale by the filmmakers, and the and he tested really well. All the audiences really like Spike. So in the last few months of post-production, Spike became a much bigger character, and he became a very prominent character in the trailers. So the last trailer of for Sinbad that went out featured Spike extensively. And the whole idea of this trailer was to try to make Sinbad seem cool. And the trailer sort of started as if it were like a Mountain Dew commercial. It had Sinbad with the voice of Brad Pitt saying something like, who's bad? Sinbad. And they showed the Sinbad ship sort of skittering across an ocean wave as if it was, you know, a scene from sort of an extreme sports surfing competition. And the whole idea was to make Sinbad seem hip with lots of scenes of this dog, Spike, and it didn't really work.
So let's look at what happened with the three movies that you followed, Terminator 3, Legally Blonde 2, and the animated film Sinbad. Were they financial or critical successes?
Kind of all over the map. I mean, Terminator 3 was actually a critically successful movie. Most critics seemed to get on board with it. Commercially, it did okay, but not great in the U.S., but made a great deal of money overseas, about $450 million worldwide, of which only $150 was in the U.S. Legally Blonde 2, not as successful as the first Legally Blonde, but solidly profitable, made about $90 million in ticket sales in the U.S., and is going to sell a lot of DVDs. Sinbad was an unqualified disaster. The losses are estimated at $100 million for DreamWorks. They just sank so much money into the hundreds of people animating the movie and then, of course, in the kind of ill-fated marketing efforts.
So what was the moral of the story for DreamWorks when Sinbad failed at the box office?
They ended up returning to their roots. They bounced back in 2004 with Shrek 2 and with Shark Tale, both computer-animated, kind of ultra-slick, edgy kind of edgy for animated movies, fair. And they just didn't even ever look back. They sort of closed the door on the traditional hand-drawn animation, and they're just looking forward into the future. They've spun off DreamWorks Animation as a separately controlled company, and they're just going to keep, you know, cranking out one or two computer animated films a year.
Studios don't like moviegoers to know how much research is going into a movie and how it's focus grouped. You describe it as a pretty secretive process. How much of it did you have access to, and how did you get that access?
Well, it was a slow, gradual process of trying to beat down the doors of the marketing executives and get them to disclose to us the full complexity of the market research process. And it took a while, and some of the events in the book are reconstructed after the fact. But we were surprised at the level to at which we were able to get access to these events, reading the transcripts, listening to the tapes of focus groups, and actually hanging out in the trailer houses where, you know, the trailers were produced. And it actually was easier than we thought, but I think, you know, what was so important to us was to prove to all of the executives that we weren't going to go away, that, you know, that this book was going to be written with or without their cooperation, and that the only chance they had of really, you know, getting the full story across was to cooperate with us and to give us, you know, as much access as possible to, you know, the market research numbers and the process.
John Gregory Dunn's book, The Studio, we talked about before we embarked on this project, and we both agreed, you know, that kind of access in which, you know, in the late 60s, he basically roamed the Fox lot, shadowing the production executives through an entire year's worth of production. It's an impossible book to write nowadays, just because of the corporate control and the kind of paranoia that grips each of these companies. They don't exactly invite you onto the lot for a chat.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Terry.
Dade Hayes and Jonathan Bing are editors at Variety. Their new book is called Open Wide. Martin Scorsese's new film, The Aviator, uses a lot of period music, including this Artie Shaw classic, Nightmare. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz considers the music in a new DVD box set collecting silent films and early talkies. This is Fresh Air. Silent movies were never totally silent. There was music and often sound effects. Music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that a new DVD set called More Treasures from American Film Archives is a collection of 50 films made between 1894 and 1931 that is also a fascinating history of film music.
Well before movies talked, filmmakers developed ways to relate visual images and sound. In films that told stories, there were, of course, the intertitles, those flashcards that tell us what characters are saying. But there was also music to underline and undermine what we're supposed to feel. On a new DVD set released by the National Film Preservation Foundation, MIT music historian and pianist Martin Marks chooses and plays music that we know is used for these particular films, or takes a well-informed guess at what that music might have been. Romantic composers like Wagner and Tchaikovsky, and popular songs of the time, were always in evidence. In the original Wizard of Oz, made in 1910, Marx uses songs from the roadshow the movie was based on. In this charming film, Dorothy was played by the 9-year-old B.B. Daniels, who later made movie history in Busby Berkeley's 42nd Street as the leading lady whose injury allows her replacement, Ruby Keeler, to go out there an unknown and come back a star. The 50 films in this set, not all of them silent, include some amazing material. A delicious interview with George Bernard Shaw. 4 minutes of one of the great 19th century actors, Joseph Jefferson, in his most famous role, Rip Van Winkle, filmed in 1896. We can watch Thomas Edison in his lab in 1897. There's even 20 seconds filmed 100 years ago of the legendary sharpshooter of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, Annie Oakley, who actually misses a shot. The music is a mid-19th century courting song called Shoot the Buffalo. One of the most fascinating films in the set is Skyscraper Symphony, a dizzying series of images of New York buildings directed by Robert Florey in 1929. We don't know what the original accompaniment was, so Marx commissioned composer Peter Child to write a new 9-minute score. It's haunting and sly and beautifully played by the Lydian String Quartet. If for no other reason, the producers of More Treasures from American Film Archives should be applauded for including one of the greatest silent movies ever made, Ernst Lubitsch's 1925 version of Oscar Wilde's witty society melodrama, Lady Windermere's Fan. You wouldn't think that such a word-conscious playwright as Wilde could survive in a version that completely leaves out what he actually wrote. Yet Lubitsch's camera and the subtle and witty score assembled and in part composed by Martin Marx capture Wilde's social nuances and true depth of feeling. ¶¶ Lubitsch's Lady Windermere's Fan is closer to the spirit of Oscar Wilde's play than most stage productions are. It's thrilling to have it, and the 49 other not-so-silent films in this set, available on home video for the first time.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed more treasures from American film archives released by the National Film Preservation Foundation. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing with music composed by the composer of our theme music, Joel Forrester. He wrote this piece, Dr. Real, to accompany a silent film.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a man whose cooking utensils include a blowtorch. We hear part two of our interview with Harold McGee. He's an expert on the science and chemistry of cooking, and he's updated his popular book on food and cooking. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.